analysis a science? Is it a Jewish science? Or what? Take it away, Anthony.
Good. I thought you were going to talk for 20 minutes and then I was going to be the I was going to oppose you. No, I've got nothing to oppose. He set me up. Right, okay. But however, I must confess that I set Joe up because he pestered me to do one of my inner circle seminars and I finally agreed. But I mischievously proposed the title is Psychoanalysis of Jewish Science, and he readily accepted, and he's plagiarized his own title for this meeting tonight also. Is psychoanalysis a Jewish science? Well, according to the Nazis, yes, and so they abolished it, or they thought they'd abolished it, but as a matter of fact, they got rid of the Jewish psychoanalysts, but there was a bunch of Aryan psychotherapists who worked in the Goering Institute, which was run by Matthias Goering, the cousin of Hermann Goering in Berlin. And it had one stream, which was in effect a psychoanalytic stream, but of course it couldn't be called that because psychoanalysis was a Jewish science. And so things like the Oedipus complex were renamed the parental configuration and things like this. But a certain amount of psychoanalysis did go on under the Nazis, and the Nazis actually used psychoanalysis to help them create their propaganda and so on. But as to the question, is psychoanalysis really a Jewish science? Well, this raises two questions. Is it a science, and is it fundamentally Jewish? Freud claimed that it was a science. At least he claimed that the psychoanalytic theory was a science. He claimed it was part of psychology, and one of the last things he ever wrote was a fragmentary note which said psychology is a natural science. What else could it be? So it follows from that that right to the end of his life, he thought that what he was doing was part of natural science, the sort of science that has been practiced about the stars and the atoms and so on, since Galileo expelled, in effect, consciousness and humanity from science. So psychoanalysis is a rather bizarre attempt to get back from this dehumanized natural science to sort of reconstruct the humanity which has actually been expelled from it. And it... Of course, it doesn't get back to the original humanity. But fortunately, Freud was not consistent. And, had he been, then psychoanalysis would be a rather horrendous affair. But fortunately, what he actually practiced at best was what he called weltliche Seelsorge, which means worldly or secular care of the soul. The cure of soul, pastoral counseling. And now the question is whether this weltliche Seelsorge, worldly care of the soul, is that a science? I mean, it's something rather analogous to mothering or fathering. Do mothers and fathers in mothering and fathering practice a science? They share a sort of tradition and they pass on tips to each other and knowledge, but it would be rather... there are all sorts of books that claim to tell mothers and fathers scientifically how to mother and father, but these are rather absurd. And similarly, a lot of the sort of textbooks of psychoanalysis are also rather absurd. However, I don't see psychoanalysis itself as absurd. I think that Freud did a great thing in creating the possibility of two people coming together to focus on, if you like, the soul, the human relationships, the problems, the aspirations, the despair, the dreams, the slips of one of them. And of course, the best qualification for the one person helping the other is that he or she has already been through the mill and knows something of his or her own soul and should have reasonably decent human relationships before starting. You can't have a scoundrel who is a good psychotherapist, at least in my opinion. And as a matter of fact, Freud was quite clear that you couldn't really have a real scoundrel as a bona fide analysand, or client, or patient, as he called them. He actually said quite clearly that a certain amount of intelligence was needed to become a psychoanalytic so-called patient. And also, there were some people who were too morally based to be taken on. There was no point in taking on certain people who were so morally depraved, debauched, whatever, that one would be colluding with them by pretending that one believed that they were embarking on a sincere search for knowledge. One simply said, as Thomas Sass put it, goodbye, Mr. Jones, I don't think we should talk anymore. The analyst always reserves the right not to take somebody on. It's different from being a doctor. I mean, if you're a doctor and you've got somebody dying, then you can't leave them. But if you are an analyst, then it's a contract between two people, or it should be. I mean, if it goes on in the health service, run by the state, then it's all highly confused and corrupted. Ideally, it should be, as Freud said, a straight relationship between two people. Preferably, one paying the other. Doesn't mean it has to be a rich person. You can take on a poor person and take a low fee, but ideally, it should be a straight deal. And you can't really do it with children. I mean, with all respect to what goes on in the Anna Freud Center up the road. Thomas Sass described child therapy, child analysis as child torture or child abuse, simply because the child can't make a contract with the analyst. Obviously, many of you here will disagree with that, but it's important that you should know that that is one point of view. Now, so this is what analysis is. Now, what about the Jewish bit? Well, if Freud was right and psychoanalysis was a natural science, then in my opinion it would be ludicrous to say it was a Jewish science. Natural science is simply science. You don't have Russian natural science or German natural science. I mean, of course you can talk about Arab mathematics and so on, but that's just talking about the people who happen to do it. But No. I mean, there's something rather obscene, almost, about the idea of a Jewish science in that sense. But in the sense of a worldly tradition of care of souls, which springs from the Jewish mystical tradition, from the Bible, from the Talmud, then I think Joe is not the first one to talk about this. Of course, I mean, he's following on a tradition of pointing this out. I mean, David Bakan was the first who wrote a book on Sigmund Freud and the Jewish mystical tradition. And this is, I think, absolutely correct that there is a relationship. But it's important not to sentimentalize it. And I mean, the Freud Museum published a paper of mine, which was actually, I originally gave 24 years ago on Freud's birthday at the Leo Beck College for the training of rabbis. And I called it Freud's Judaism, Renewal and Betrayal, because I thought that in many ways Freud betrayed the Jewish tradition. In many ways, he made use of bits of it, but he was remarkably ignorant of many bits of it. And I argued that it was sentimentalizing Freud's Jewishness and Judaism to try to present him sort of unequivocally as a great man in the Jewish tradition. You see, Joe tends to argue, as the people I was arguing against here argued, that if Freud doesn't seem to know some fairly elementary things about Judaism, this is because he really knows but is dissembling, because he's trying to present himself as a Viennese German Christian gentleman physician. And so he's pretending he doesn't know Hebrew and doesn't know Yiddish and doesn't know the Bible. And so, well, he'll admit to knowing a certain amount, but only so much. But the fact is, I think he, in many respects, he really didn't know so much. I mean, if he was playing at being a Christian gentleman, he fell for his own game, and he succeeded too much in becoming one. I mean, there are some very elementary things about Judaism that Freud makes howlers about. For example, his Moses of Michelangelo, he muddles up the two ascents and descents of Moses, the two different sets of tablets with the commandments on. He muddles up, it'd take too long to explain it here, but basically he thinks that Michelangelo's sculpture shows Moses angry because of the Israelites and the golden calf. Well, this can't be, because Moses has got horns, which mean the rays of light, which were streaming when Moses was in an ecstasy on the second occasion. And so Freud has interpreted and has gone to great trouble to get somebody even to reconstruct what he thinks are Moses' different positions, as that the sculpture is a sort of sculpture.
Give me a couple more minutes.
Then. Yeah, okay. Whereas actually, if you see the statue in the way that Michelangelo wanted it to be in the Victoria and Albert Museum, where you can look at it, they've got a copy of it, and you can look at it up high, you can see that Moses is Michelangelo clearly means Moses not to be in a state of anger, but in a state of awe. He's just seen God going past. And Freud doesn't understand one bit of this. How is this? This is elementary stuff. And then what I attacked in my paper, what I called Freud's betrayal of Judaism, he talks from time to time about the principle of love your neighbor as yourself. In Civilization and Its Discontents, he mentions that this principle is older than Christianity, but he doesn't say who before Christianity had this principle. And of course it's in Leviticus, it's a central principle of Judaism. But Freud doesn't understand what it means. He interprets it in a sort of sentimental Christian sort of way, as if it means you go down the street feeling full of love for everybody. And he even refers to St. Francis. I mean, St. Francis was a terrible character who was not kind to animals at all. St. Francis didn't even keep up to the most elementary Jewish rules by which you would assess whether a whole people was decent, God-fearing. If they cut off the limbs of a living animal to eat, then this is not something that a decent civilization will do, according to the Jewish Bible, according to the Torah. And St. Francis blessed one of his monks who cut off the trotter of a living pig to give to some visiting celebrity. But Freud thinks that Francis is a great loving man. So Freud is full of these Christian cliches. He doesn't understand the love your neighbour as yourself. He doesn't understand that it's the whole of the holiness code in Leviticus builds up gradually to this principle, explaining what loving your neighbour means in great detail. You mustn't have revenge, you mustn't take revenge, you mustn't have hate in your heart, you must speak out, and so on and so on. So 24 years ago, I think it was, I argued this, and nothing I have learned about Freud in this quarter of a century has made me retract my indignation about Freud's betrayal of Judaism. If anything, it has strengthened it.
Fine, thank you. It's nice to have someone who's controversial here. I have a variety of opinions about Freud, but Freud did want to be seen as an eminent German secular intellectual. That was his overt persona. Now, I would like to just mention, in terms of a science, and perhaps you don't know, perhaps you do, that Freud first became famous, as a neuroanatomist. And his fame was that he was the first person to dissect the testicle of an eel. First person to dissect the testicle of an eel. Then he had many findings in histology, and wrote a book on aphasia, difficulty understanding words, which is now still the classic book in neurology. He wanted to be an objective scientist. I'm trying to think about, what is science? It's a methodology, it's a focus. Does it have a Jewish methodology? Does it have a Jewish focus or not? Polly, I'd like to call upon Polly Wilmerthal now.
Right, well, thank you, Anthony. That was a very fascinating presentation. My role is something completely different.
Oh, thank God for that.
there are cultural determinants which establish the way that people see certain phenomena. And so I'm not speaking specifically about Freud, but about the phenomenon of psychoanalysis, the phenomenon of the wise person that you come to, and you lie on a couch, and you talk, and he listens, or she listens to what you say. And then there is some comment, a word, which somehow opens your heart and pops inside and enables you to be empowered concerning some aspect of your inner life, which previously you had no control over and was enslaving you. Now, what I am trying to present are Jewish ideas, particularly focusing on Hasidism, but I'm going to start with something long before Hasidism began as a movement. We have in the Bible the concept of a Jewish king. Now, what is the king? He's a leader, leads people into battle. With King Solomon, we see him as a judge. But just occasionally, we see him in a different mode, because the Bible tells us in the book of Deuteronomy that once every 7 years, the king goes to the temple, and the temple is crowded with people. And the king gives an inspiring talk. It's once every 7 years. He turns into, from being a warrior or a judge, he turns into someone who inspires people. All right. It's a long way from a therapist. But it's a step towards a personal relationship, albeit with a crowd of people, not an individual. Well, now that's an image. In fact, this year would be that seventh year when the king would do exactly that. So this idea of gathering together, there's a sense in which this interesting gathering is such a hakel, it's called a gathering of people in the temple. Now, historians of the history of Jewish thought in the early modern period talk about the way in which at a certain point the rabbi, who was a kind of a scholar of the Talmud, and if you had a problem in Jewish law or a dispute with another person, he was a judge, he would tell you whether it is kosher or not kosher, forbidden, permitted, suddenly turned into a kind of Renaissance man. A person who has all knowledge, albeit at that period in a Jewish sphere, but nonetheless incorporating philosophy, mathematics. People like the Maharal of Prague, don't worry about his making a golem, but the idea that the Maharal was a sage, rabbi as sage. Now that, I believe, is one color in the palette if we're going to try to put together a composite picture of what Freud was involved in creating. The sage that you come to and you talk about the most intimate things in your life, in fact, things that you never realized were part of your life before, because only now, in the presence of this special, unique, wise person, are you able to access those elements of your own unconscious and memory which you hadn't really dared to think about before. Now, another element is the Hasidic element. And here we go to the figure of the Baal Shem, the master of the divine name. Now, this was a kind of metier from the 16th, 17th century onwards. There are quite a number that we know about. They've been researched in various ways. The historian Emmanuel Etkus at Hebrew University in Jerusalem put together a very skillful presentation of different Baalei Shem. They used a combination of folk medicine that anyone might use, which was influenced by the quote-unquote official medicine of the day, together with spiritual input and insight. So the spiritual input would be things like divine names. That's why he's called the master of the name. He would use a divine name and give a person an amulet with a divine name written on it, a rolled up piece of parchment. It would sometimes be in a long triangle. Divine names would be written, then it would be rolled up and put into a little locket or something like that. And the person would carry it or have it by their bed or in their home. Now, when we come to the Baal Shem Tov, the man Israel Baal Shem Tov, who founded Hasidism, who's a real character. We even have the taxman's report about him in 1740, in the 1740s. The records of the little town where he lived, Medziboz, are in Krakow, because that's where the family which owned Medziboz were the counts. Moshe Rossman, a colleague of mine, he analyzed these and saw how the taxman listed the Baal Shem Tov. At one point he called him doctor, and another point he called him Kabbalista, a Kabbalistic doctor. So that's from the non-Jewish sources about the Baal Shem Tov living in Medziboz in the 1740s. He died in 1760. Now, the Baal Shem Tov also had mystical insight, and that means he would tell people, and they accepted it, there is an argument going on in heaven about your particular situation, and for that reason you should do this or you shouldn't do that. Now, thinking about this evening that we have tonight, I was at a conference somewhere else. I was in Boston.
Excuse me, Tyler, 2 more minutes. Maybe 2.5.
The death instinct.
And I mentioned this project that we have this evening. And someone said, oh, do you know the Baal Shem Tov gave therapy to someone? I said, where do you get that from? And eventually, a few emails later, they actually told me, and I managed to find the book. It was printed in 1883, and the writer tells of something his grandfather witnessed in the time of the Balfour. It just fits as far as the dates are concerned. And what happened was that there was a wealthy man whose son was what they call in Hebrew Meshuga, or Yiddish. He was mad. It's quite interesting how they looked after him. There was a carer, an individual carer, who was all the time with this mad person. And the wife of the wealthy man said, listen, there's this famous person, the Baal Shem Tov, he's known to give all kinds of cures. Why don't we take our son to him? So it was beneath the dignity of the wealthy man to do that. Instead, he said to the city council in the town where he lived, let's invite this rabbi, the Baal Shem Tov, for a Shabbat to our city. I'll pay the money involved. So he invited the Baal Shem Tov to the town, and during that time, he took the opportunity to go to the Baal Shem Tov and say, I have a son who is Meshuga, who is mad. Can you help him? Would you give me an amulet for him? Something like that. The Baal Shem Tov said, that kind of case needs special treatment. I will see your son. And what happened was, he saw the son for several days in succession, each time for a certain period of time. Like, it doesn't say exactly, but it gives the impression, half an hour, 2 hours. He saw the son several days in a row, and the son didn't become, from my reading of the text, didn't become perfectly, quote-unquote, cured, but he became more manageable and more in charge of himself. And then there's another story where the son is a hero in an interesting way. So it's an example of therapy from a figure like a Hasidic rabbi. Now, the Baal Shem Tov was the founder of Hasidism. And what Hasidism meant was that there is a group, a person, or a group of people who have a relationship with a figure because the Baal Shem Tov learnt a way to transmit his skill to others.
Kali, one more minute.
Is it really? Yeah, okay. He learnt how to transmit his skill to others. And the way in which he did this, he taught a person to recognize the self within the other. But when that person tells you something painful, something problematic in his own life, you should recognize that that is inside you as well. And by you finding a way to repair that wounded aspect within yourself, you will find the way to help that other person. Now, the key moment for that kind of relationship is called Yechidut, where the individual comes to the Rebbe and is alone with him in a room by himself, or it could be a woman coming for Yechidut with the Rebbe. And that is a very intense meeting of souls. And that concept, when we consider the way in which there is this imagery in the Jewish people, which Freud was aware of, there are similarities and great differences. But I think some level of consciousness of this kind of Rebbe-Chassid relationship may well have influenced the emergence of the all-knowing, subtle, spiritual, in the sense of Freud's use of language, the psyche, the psychoanalyst.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. It's interesting that both Polly and Anthony use the word soul, mentioning the word psyche. Bruno Bettelheim wrote a book called Freud and Man's Soul, which he pointed out that psychoanalysis, or the writings of Freud, was systematically mistranslated by straitjacket. It was systematically mistranslated and aimed to a materialistic, objective, scientific basis, which still continues to this day. But he says, psychoanalysis really, psyche means soul, so it's soul analysis. And Freud, like a great writer, was very specific in his words. He was a Goethe of German literature. So we're coming back again. Is it a science? Is it an art? What is it really? Certainly, it's worth considering the image of a soul and what is a soul. Anyway, Stephen, I can't.
Thank you. Quite telling. I don't think I've ever felt quite at home at this, in this museum as I do on this panel, which is very sweet. And also I can't resist commenting that even if this isn't a very gender diverse panel, we at least have species diversity with Teva here on the panel.
But you're attributing to me a certain gender.
And also, it gives me the chance, if nobody else has done it, to tell you the story about Freud and his dog in the consulting room, and how I used to get up, you know, to let the dog out and get up again to let the dog in. And there's occasion where the patient is talking and the dog gets a bit distressed, so Freud gets up and lets the dog out and says to the patient, "Dog didn't like what you said." The patient says, "Am I paying you or the dog?" I think I've now wasted about 3 minutes of my time, which, if this wasn't an unlimited session, would have cost me £4. Move on. Wave my hand less, yes. No, actually, it's fine, because if it's actually an analytic session, the rest of the session will be silent anyway. I'd love to take up some of the things, particularly Tavi just raised, and maybe we can in the discussion afterwards. But I think I would like to just spend my few minutes giving a bit of a frame about this discussion of whether there is a Jewish component to psychoanalysis itself, which is not to contest Anthony's argument before that the relationship between psychoanalysis, or specifically Freud, and Judaism is perhaps tenuous. I certainly don't think that Freud was a hidden chassid, and this may be an issue that Joe wants to come back on. Although I do accept, particularly after the work of Yerushalmi, which some of you no doubt will know, and his fantastic book, Freud's Moses, Analysis, Terminable and Interminable, I'm not sure that is actually the title, is it? That's a good test there.
In German.
Yerushalmi's claim that Freud actually knew much more than he let on, I mean, he must have known more, for example, to be able to understand the melitza, the combination of different biblical verses that his own father had written at the front of the Bible that he gave to Freud on Freud's 35th birthday. That's an argument which I think is kind of fairly well established. Freud probably did know more than he let on, and he did at various times try and cover his traces. But still, it's quite clear he had a very strong identity as Jewish. So I'll make a few separable points. Firstly, Jewish science, as already been commented on, the notion of psychoanalysis and Jewish science is in part a Nazi notion, and so it suffers from opprobrium as such. What does it mean to be a Jewish science? Psychoanalysis was Jewish psychology, according to Jung as well, who contrasted it with Aryan psychology. Just like Einstein was engaged with Jewish physics, these were terms of opprobrium. And they relate in part to the reason why both those figures, Freud and Einstein, had to leave their places, their Europe, their German-speaking places, indeed their language, their mother tongue, the German, and move to places as they saw them as freedom. In fact, psychoanalysis moves from being a German language invention to an English language to an English language social science, I'd say, in that period. So the Nazis were as Jewish science, but there is something in this that I'd like to rescue, and this is the idea that there is a way of thinking specifically about social science as always situated. If you want to do a study of people, so we're not talking about natural science now, if you want to do a study of people, what it means to be a human subject, to participate in a social world, a study which maybe you affect in the way that you set about doing that study, because you yourself come from somewhere. If, for example, you want to study Freud or psychoanalysis, and you yourself are Jewish, this makes a difference. It makes a difference. Doesn't mean you're not doing something which falls under the general remit of science. It just means that it's necessary to notice what it is that you yourself bring to this study. You have to notice how, as I say, situated your approach is, how specific it is to you, to your culture, to your gender, to your race, whatever it is that's particular to this kind of moment of trying to understand what might be going on for other people as individuals or indeed in their social generality. Psychoanalysis, of course, does that. Psychoanalysis emphasizes the way in which the subjecthood of the analyst or researcher, if you're going to use that term, makes a difference to the thing that they're studying. You couldn't do psychoanalytic therapy if you didn't have some kind of level of awareness of your own capacity to influence what's happening in that environment, in the consulting room. And also, you can do real social science without some capacity to theorize what it is about you as a researcher that you bring to this mode of work. So I'd say this business about psychoanalysis, science, is it Jewish? Well, yes, it is then, because there are going to be elements of it that are situated in specificity, both of its origins and its assumptions. And some of those origins and some of those assumptions, by no means all of them, but some of them are particularly Jewish. What I want to say about that is that there's a lot of material in Freud's life that relates to it. Again, there's only a few moments here, so I'll sketch couple of them very quickly. One is this business of speaking from the margins. Freud is an example of emancipated secular Jew of the late 19th century who holds within him the entire promise of emancipation, of absorption into the most culturally developed society ever at that period, the German-speaking society of Middle Europe. And so there he is, highly educated in that society, no longer in the ghetto, no longer religious. His father gives up his own Hasidism. Freud never even has to confront that. And at the same time, through the pervasiveness of anti-Semitism, Sandra Gilman says, the thing that you would know, you would think first about somebody you met in the street in the Vienna of this period is, are they Jewish or not? Not, are they male, are they female, are they Jewish? Okay? Anti-Semitism is pervasive. So, and Freud is excluded from various possible places because of that anti-Semitism. So there's the margin, you know? Both in and out. You know, there's this famous thing in Freud in Beyond the Pleasure Principle, the thought dar game. You know, the child who throws his wooden roll, wooden toy into out of sight and pulls it back again, thought dar, there, gone. Well, that's an emblem for what it was like to be Jewish at that moment of Freud's education and Freud's transferal into becoming a psychoanalyst. You're in and you're out, you're there and you're not there. Jews are part of the society and then they're excluded from it. Most, of course, dramatically at the end of Freud's life when he had to flee Vienna after the Anschluss. That place of marginality is not only Jewish. Of course, there are other people who are marginals. But it is exquisitely Jewish at the particular point at which psychoanalysis emerges in its particular place. And that gives it a certain kind of handle on things, which Freud himself comments on. He says he doesn't have to be part of the compact majority, to quote from Ibsen, you know, from Enemy of the People. Place where it's come from. He doesn't have to be part of the compact majority precisely because he's a Jew. He's used to being outside. Then there's some very practical things. Freud's, partly because of this, Freud's early lectures on dreams are given to the B'nai B'rit in Vienna. Those are the people who are his first audience. Lay, secular, Jewish audience, professionals, interested in the world, pursuing a certain kind of ethic of rationality, of soberness, of communal contribution, those kind of ethics which are kind of very close to the classical kind of both religious and secular Jewish ethics, and also close to the psychoanalytic ethic. What does it mean to be psychoanalytically developed? It means to have a capacity to hold to a place of stability when everything else around you is in turmoil, to think, to tolerate ambivalence, to perform certain kinds of moderation in the face of irrationality, to contest barbarism. These are kind of Jewish values. They're not only Jewish, I don't want to say that, but they are nevertheless Jewish. And they're very key to the values that are endemic to the B'nai B'rit at this period and ever after. And of course, that's why when you read the Interpretation of Dreams, you get all these Jewish dreams. because they're said, they're, first of all, because they're Freud's dreams, which is also fascinating. Here we have a science founded on the personal dream life of its founder. Very interesting that. But also they're Jewish dreams because they were originally told to a Jewish audience. And then they are, reappear in this founding text of the 20th century, 1900 on its flyleaf, Interpretation of Dreams. The century is never going to be the same again after that book's published into the Jewish book. Freud also had all these identifications with Joseph, because Joseph is an interpreter of dreams. With Moses, because Moses is killed by his followers, who fall, you know, who are constantly plotting against him and can't tolerate him. That's Freud's version of the Moses story. It's not the one I kind of remember from Freud, but there you go. Although Moses does criticise his people for not praying for him so that he could enter the promised land. So Freud has got something there. Indeed, Freud has dreams like that. He dreams of Rome. It's really interesting. He dreams of Rome. But the dream is called by Freud a dream of the promised land seen from afar. So there you have Rome, Christian, or certainly non-Jewish mythological symbol. How can I get to Rome? And it's transformed in Freud's imagination, in his unconscious, and in his rendering of his unconscious, into a Jewish symbol. The promised land seen from afar. And there's Freud standing on his mountain looking over, not able to get there. To dream about Rome, a non-Jewish dream, it becomes Jewish in Freud's unconscious. Okay, I won't ask you how many minutes I've got. I've got
two more minutes.
Freud was not religious, he wasn't a Zionist, he speaks about that himself, and he still talks about the emotional and indecipherable connection he has with Jewishness. He doesn't understand it, but it's definitely there. And right at the end of his life, he talks about psychoanalysis as a continuation of Judaism. Closing the Vienna Psychoanalytic Society just before he leaves, Freud quotes something he also quotes in the Moses the Monotheist. He says, when Titus destroyed Jerusalem, Jochanan ben Zakkai said to him, let me go to Yavne and make a new college, somewhere to learn Yeshiva. This is what he asked for. And Freud says to his followers in Vienna, now we're going to do the same. We're going to go into exile and take our books of learning with us. And it's a beautiful analogy and a beautiful image, but it's also quite precise. Psychoanalysis, secular as it is an extension into the mid-20th century, into the Nazi and then hopefully post-Nazi period of Judaism. It's an extension of the same thing in Freud's mind. Quickly on what could be the Jewish ideas in psychoanalysis. There's too much to talk about here in the meal time I have available, but I'll pick up a couple of brief points. Sexuality. Why should sexuality be Jewish? Well, it is in the context of the kind of thinking that we have in the 19th century, particularly racialized anti-Semitism. The Jew is a sexualized being. Not only that, a Jewish man is a feminized being. Why? Because of circumcision, which makes him castrated. So the Jew is like, Jewish man is like a woman, which is one reason why the Jewish man can be hysterical. The non-Jewish man is going to be hysterical. Hysterics are women. But the Jewish man can be hysterical. And this feminization of the Jew is also a sexualization because it makes the Jew important in a way that the non-Jew is focused much more on something, what can we call it, intellectual, spiritual. Very ironic because Freud's own claim is in Moses Monotheism is that Judaism is superior to Christianity because Judaism is intellectual because it has an abstract notion of God. You have to imagine your God. It's patriarchal. And Christianity is a reversion to matriarchy because it needs all these, thinking about Catholicism here, it needs all these images to sustain it. It has this whole business about Madonna and all that kind of stuff. Freud sees Christianity as a reversion to something more primitive than Judaism, a little bit of Jewish accent there, or colonialism, I don't know. I think two quick points and then stop, I suppose, yeah? Another parallel I'd make is around this question of hermeneutics. Judaism is a deeply interpretive religion. It is text-based. And as we know, the textual associations of Judaism are about how you can interpret this text, which has a truth, but a truth that can only be got to through all sorts of human errors. That's why there are 70 ways. That's why the Torah has 70 faces, 70 meaning infinite here. So many ways of thinking about it. That's why all the arguments that you get in the Talmud, for example, the textual arguments, the exact words matter, the spaces between the words matter, just as they do in the talk of the Amalisan. Exactly what you say, exactly what you talk about. That's what's key in psychoanalysis. Again, it's not only psychoanalysis, but it's so true of psychoanalysis, the hermeneutic approach. One has to think there might be something, what can we say, in a Jewish psychoanalysis, a Jewish culture, which promotes that way of trying to think about why words might matter and why it might be that words can make a difference. Because it's the most peculiar thing, the thing that just talking about something can change it. Yeah, that's precisely what psychoanalysis, and indeed in many ways Judaism, is based on. But finally, I want to come back to a set of...
One more minute.
All right. Two points. One is critical. There's a lot of talk, for example, about how Jewish mysticism might be parallel to psychoanalysis. For example, the parallels between the idea of tikkun, of healing the world of its suffering, and reparation, healing, doing, making good the damage that you've done, a Kleinian notion. My thought about that is that there is a parallel there, but it's not to do with it directly. It's not a directly causal one. The one does not cause the others. Tikkun does not lead to reparation. They are both responses to deep suffering. In the case of the mystical notion of tikkun, it has to do with the exile from Spain in the late 15th century and the reaction of Jewish mystics to that. How can we make sense of this great trauma? What damage has been done? How can we make the world whole again in the face of that? In the context of Kleinianism, it has to do with the intense suffering, first of the First World War and then later of the Second World War. How can we make good the damage that we have done? It's the same question, so it's not surprising that parallel answers are given to this question. Reparation, tikkun, healing, building out of the damage we've done into something fine. Doesn't mean one thing has caused another. But my final point is back to this question of marginality. I think there is something very fascinating about how things that are in the margins and never properly dealt with, they keep returning. Psychoanalysis is, if nothing else, a discipline of repetition. It's not just that you keep repeating everything when you go to your analysis 5 times a week, 7 years, 8 years, 9 years. You know, what else can you do if nothing new to talk about for a while? It's not just that kind of repetition, it's the way that things which hover and are not yet fully dealt with, are not fully symbolized, are not fully made, are not fully owned and made whole, keep coming back to haunt you. And the same is true in particularly, specifically European culture, maybe worldwide, of the Jews. Freud notices this. Even Slavoj Žižek has a very ambiguous relationship around Jewishness and draws on some of the tropes I've been talking about. Even he notices that the more Jews are wished away, the more they seem to come back. The process of endless return, which I think is also something which is kind of available as a set of images about what psychoanalysis works on as it moves from this complicated cultural terrain.
Thank you, Stephen. When I first thought of this topic, I thought, is psychoanalysis a science? And of course it's a science. It's a methodology and a focus. All science has that methodology. And particular science, I think we're talking about, is not just objective science, as a materialistic science, as Freud tried to discuss and tried to explore, particularly in his book, The Project, but as a science of subjectivity. Science of subjectivity. And that's the focus. And is it a Jewish science? Well, a study about 10 years ago said that 60% of all psychoanalysts in America were Jewish, or of Jewish origin. So I think that we can say there's a great Jewish input into it. And the input is not just as a methodology, but as a, from his background. He came from a very religious background. His mother, father, and wife, all of whom were Hasidim, and his wife was the granddaughter of Chief Rabbi Pamper. So I was thinking about this in terms of religion, in terms of science, and I think, go back to the issue of religion. Freud, of course, despised religion. But did he really? He despised it for its ceremonial function. In fact, he forbade his wife to light Shabbos candles after they got married, and after he promised her they would keep the traditions. And after he passed away, his wife Martha remarked to Isaiah Berlin, the philosopher, He was asking her about Freud, and said, she said, that mumser, that bastard. Even forbade me to light Sabbath candles. And she lit Sabbath candles for the rest of her life. The background of it, his background, and he seeped through. I just wanted to mention one quote from Ernest Jones, who was his biographer. And he was trying to deny the fact, trying to contest the fact that Freud had created a secular illusion, a new secular illusion. He said, and to caricature it. It was this element that gave rise to the general condition of our world beside the activities. They partook rather of the nature of a religious movement, he's saying, and he's characterized. Amusing parallels were drawn. Freud, of course, was the Pope of a new sect, if not a higher personage, to whom all owed obedience. His writings were a sacred text, credence which was obligatory on the supposed infallibilist who had undergone the necessary conversion, a long analysis, and it were not lacking the heretics who were expelled from the church. Jones also mentioned there was an element of truth in the amusing picture he portrayed. Indeed, if you substitute Rebbe for Pope, Hasidism for new sect, God for high personage, and Bible for the sacred text, then you can find a fairly accurate description of the Hasidic milieu from which Freud emerged. So, and I talk about in my book, The Hidden Freud. There were two Freuds. There was Freud, the overt Freud, the secular German intellectual who hated religion. Incidentally, Anthony said Freud didn't know much about Jewish customs, really. His colleague Silverstein, with whom we were in Spanish.
That's a little bit more complicated.
It's more complicated. Yeah. Said that he never forgot a language. He knew many languages. We could say that Freud never forgot a custom. And when his mother died at the age of about 95 in the 1930s, he meticulously arranged her funeral according to most orthodox Jewish customs. And then he didn't go to it.
He did not go to it.
But he meticulously arranged it. We could say that, it leads me to think that, what is psychoanalysis? Is it a religion? Science, yes. Is it a kind of religion? Religion, if you think of it as a kind of spiritual endeavor, understanding Freud's attitude, one has to realize that Freud hated spiritualism. In the 19th century, there's a lot of people, Madame Blavatsky and Gurdjieff and others, who were spiritualists. And it was this together with the kind of ritual which he despised. But he himself knew the text. He studied the Bible on his father's knee. And the psychoanalyst Emmanuel Rice points out, and going back to his gymnasium records, he was the leading Hebrew scholar in the gymnasium and had to pass rigorous examinations in Hebrew, and so forth. And of course he studied in his library, and he had books on Kabbalah, the French and German, and studied Kabbalah with Rabbi Safran, who was the chief rabbi of Geneva. So there was two Freuds, the overt Freud and the covert Freud. He was particularly keen to avoid being seen as a Jew. Why as a Jew? Because his family came from Eastern Russia, Eastern Ukraine, from the area known as Galicia. And Galicia Jews to Viennese Jews were a bit like Somalis were to St. John's Wood Jews here today, or people in St. John's Wood. Somalis, you think of attitudes to Somalis, often it's dirty, dark, poor, crooks and so forth. It's very much the same attitude for Louisianas. And he was trying to avoid this desperately, as he was very ambitious. So we could say that, yes, it was a science, it was a methodology, it was a Jewish, heavily involved with Jewish methodology, from study of sexuality to, as Stephen points out, the issue of Tikkun, many issues are really deeply involved in the Zohar, or known as the Bible of Jewish mystical tradition, the Kabbalah. I think that it was a science and not a science. A religion and not a religion. Historical romance and not historical romance. All of them. But it's the one thing which psychoanalysis is, was the way in which the Jewish mystical tradition entered the mainstream of Western culture. The way in which the Kabbalah entered the mainstream of Western culture in all its methodology and all its focus. And these things which I discuss very much in my book, The Hidden Torah. Anyway, I'd like to open the floor to discussion now. Ivan, you very pick on people?
Anybody needs
I just wanted to share this one rather simple thought that I've had during the course of the evening, and that is that the source of Jewish knowledge is the unconscious God, and of course the source of psychoanalytic knowledge is the invisible God, and the source of psychoanalytic knowledge is the invisible unconscious.
Anybody want to comment on that?
Let a few people say
I think people that are familiar with Judaism and they understand Judaism, they can see a lot of it in the writing of Freud. For instance, he adored Joseph of the Old Testament, and he wrote the Book of Dreams. And also, I'm sure he read Tehillim, because in it, it talks about day and night, Thanatos and Eros. And the skull in Hebrew, memory, and maybe repressed memory, I'm sure he understood it. And also, my question is, or my reflection is that Freud in the beginning was interested in Michelangelo's Moses. He went four times to Rome and he couldn't face the statue. But then towards the end of his life, I think he wanted to be the Moses of the Old, unconsciously the Moses of the Old Testament. What's your reflection on this?
Can I say something? Yeah. Thank you. I wanted to say something. I was putting the opposition view, as it were, to Joe's position. But I think that there are quite a lot of things that can be said further on the side of Joe's position. In fact, you don't even put it as strongly as you could in your book. For example, you give a mistranslation of Safran's letter. It's actually stronger than the English translation that you give. He says that... He says that Freud took a great interest. You have it that he took a great interest in the relations between Judaism and psychoanalysis, but that's not what he says. I mean, we can take that for granted. What he actually says, he took a great interest in this specific verse about Cain and Abel, and its commentary in the Talmud. So that's, I think that's stronger than And what I was going to say is, although I think I'm right that there are extraordinary gaps in Freud and understanding of Judaism. And of course he had a great understanding of parts of it. It's just poetry. But he himself said that he, that his early immersion in the Bible story, or the Bible history, determined the whole course of his life. And his Bible is still here, in the museum. And I've been looking at it, yesterday and today, just to remind myself of when I used to look at it when I was a Freud fellow here, a quarter of a century ago. A quarter of a century ago, I'll let you in on a secret, which, I found, in Freud's Bible, a little pressed flower, dried flower, and I wasn't sure whether it had got in there by accident or, but I mean, how does a flower get into a Bible by accident? And I even took it to the herbarium at Kew Gardens to get them to identify it. You know, they looked through hundreds of drawers and eventually they found it. It's a little common chickweed, but a pretty little chickweed. But yesterday, when I was looking again at the Bible, I found another two flowers at a different place in the Bible. And then today I came back and I looked at every single page in the Bible just to make sure that there weren't any others. And there weren't. But you might be interested at the places where these three flowers were in the Bible. The one that I found a quarter of a century ago was in Leviticus 6, I think. The page on which it occurs has got Leviticus 6:6, which refers to the Esh Tamid, the eternal flame that that has to be kept going, never to go out. And the light, the Ne'er Tamid in the synagogue is the modern day equivalent of it. There's one light in the synagogue, which, you know, near the ark, which is never allowed to go out. And the page where the other two pressed flowers were, which I discovered yesterday, is the page where Joseph's brothers come to Egypt, and they, or 10 of them, and they appear before Joseph. They don't recognize Joseph. He recognizes them, and he remembers his dreams, which he interpreted, or they interpreted, as being about them. So maybe this is pure coincidence. Maybe this is accident. I haven't yet got the flowers dated. I presume there must be some way of finding out whether these pressed flowers could actually date back to Freud's time or somebody else's. But it's an interesting starting point, it seems, for a bit of research. The eternal light and Joseph, the dreamer with whom Freud identified. So, I mean, Joe's hypothesis has got a great deal on its side. I just wanted to point out that I thought there was a certain amount of sentimentalizing and schmaltzy romanticizing of Freud's Judaism, which I didn't like very much. Not from you, Joe, actually, but from other people.
Are you going to answer the lady's question?
I'm sorry. I thought I was, because you talked about Joseph.
You did.
You talked about Moses.
Joseph,
and
yes. But my question was something else. It's a
Whether he saw himself as Moses. Well, of course he saw himself as Moses. He said he did, yeah.
Christ.
Freud identified with, name a character in history, Freud identified with him. I mean, Moses, Jesus,
Hannibal,
William the Conqueror, when he was in Calais waiting to come across to England, you know, when he was going into exile, although it was very nice exile in England, he loved coming to England. The night before he crossed the Channel, he dreamt he was William the Conqueror at the Battle of Hastings.
I think there is something more to it. There's something more to it than that, which is at the point of writing Moses and Monotheism, which was written between 1933 and 1939, Freud is in his late 70s and to his 80s, ill, having to become an exile from the place he lived for practically the whole of his life. And thinking about the question of the continuity of Jewish cultural identity.
Yeah.
What is it that gets transmitted across the generations? Let's just say for a moment, for it's not religious. I mean, this agreement is not religious, I think, even if there's some varying views on how knowledgeable it was. So it's not a sort of a matter of belief, and it's not a simple matter of heredity, genetic and biological heredity, although Freud never completely ruled that out. It's not what interests him. What interests him is what gets passed down from one generation to another that then forms you in your core, in your unconscious life, as a specific member of a particular kind of people. And this is why Freud's attracted in this, what seems on the face of it to be rather odd way, to Lamarckianism. You know, you've probably heard, I'm sure most of you know, but just in case, this distinction, this idea of the Lamarckian transmission, in which something that occurs in a particular generation can then be passed down as if it affects the genes. It's kind of disreputable, although there's some elements of it coming back into favour now, funnily enough. It was even disreputable when Freud wrote about it in the 1930s, although not completely, because there was an association between Lamarckianism and Jews and Bolshevism on the one hand, and Darwinism and Nazism on the other hand. The association was, if it's true that the events of your life can really change everything, then change the environment and you change the Jew. The Jews can be released from their suffering and indeed their neuroses. Whereas if it's all Darwinist and it's all kind of passed down only through the genes, nothing can change. It's fixed racially. I mean, that's an aside, okay, so forget that if you like, but come back to my main point, which is that Freud's interest in mosaicism is what kind of event, historical event, repeated historical event, can make a difference and draw you in to a certain kind of cultural body generation after generation, even if you don't want it. You know, even if you don't want it.
Can I just take advice from cutting this? To respond to what you're saying.
I'm speaking.
I thought I might be going to interrupt, but when you said that, I feel as though what I was thinking about is sort of connected with this, because it seems to me what you're talking about is what survives and what is the nature of this kind of mysterious mechanism whereby some things survive and others don't. And it seems to me that one of the most fundamental things about whatever this Judaism is, Jewishness, Judaism is this remarkable character for surviving. And I was thinking about when people refer to understanding Judaism as though there was some kind of position one could arrive at, which was understanding Judaism, which I find about this sort of confusing notion of what is it to understand Judaism, and what's the relationship between understanding Jewishness and simply being Jewish, because that seems to me what you were sort of touching on in relation to Freud is that there's a sort of, there can be an absolute conviction I am Jewish, completely separated from a sort of position which might say I understand, and that seems to me, and it's that parallel survival of two things, and what's the relationship between something which could be called understanding, which does seem often to relate to a text or something of that sort, and another experience, which is just a very strange one of, you know, somehow knowing you're Jewish but not knowing what the hell that's really about.
I think that's completely right, and it means that in that book, something more is, and I agree there's an identification with Moses, I think that's really clear, but I think something more is happening there, and it's precisely that question of what gets transmitted. I mean, it's called, in fact, Yerushalmi calls it a trilling wire in the soul. It's quite a nice play on, he's playing on the name of Lionel Trilling, just as an aside, but the kind of literary critic, Freudian literary critic of the 1950s, who was also interested in these questions of transmission and what you see in text. A trilling wire in the soul, though, is an interesting idea because it suggests something, Joe's trope on the soul, Seelah. You know, it suggests something around identification and unconscious transmission, which it does not reduce to knowledge, and yet somehow is perpetuated. And there is lots of problems with that. Too mystically here, is it something material? I mean, Freud, sorry, I'll stop in a moment, but just to take up a point of Joe's, Joe said that Freud hated, I think you said, spiritualism. But Freud was very interested in the occult. And he did believe in telepathy.
He belonged to the London Society for Psychical Research.
Exactly, he was a corresponding member of the London Society for Psychical Research, and indeed wrote a paper for them on the unconscious in 1912. So he's very interested in that, but he has this idea about, specifically telepathy, that he, Freud, is developing a material science, the unconscious, and the unconscious is an explanation of telepathy. So he says it's like a telephone. You know, there's a transmitter and a receiver, and you just can't see the wire which goes under the ground. That's the unconscious. So it's a kind of mixed thing. He's very interested in the occult. He thinks there's something to it, but he also thinks it might be explicable in terms of he's developing within in his own mind the science of psychoanalysis.
Thank you.
So,
I don't know if this is going to help. I'm losing my voice, but I'm going to try. I agree with all of you.
That's not a Jewish comment. You've got to say, I disagree with everybody.
No, but that's very Talmudic.
Exactly. I was interested in a reverse question, which is built on what you're talking about hermeneutics, but is the Torah Freudian? Because I was thinking about both the intensity of the language, the focus on even finding words within words, and looking at letters and within the words, but also the role, the Torah built on gaps. So you have, before Abraham takes Isaac up, it says, after this happened. And there's nothing explained about what, and then when Isaac and Isaiah bury him, they don't say what happened. Like, there's all these little gaps in it. There's missing pieces. It's not realism. It's not Dickens. It's not filled in. And then the other thing is that it's about trauma and the repetition of trauma. But also resilience and what carries on, what gets transmitted through trauma, but also how we recover. Because you see these sibling rivalries, these traumatic events that keep repeating and repeating. But eventually things start to change generation to generation. So children are blessed without the rivalry. So there's some sort of resolution through the unconscious in the family history. So there's something, I don't know what his knowledge would be. I do have a question as well. I was curious in terms of he's adopting as well. I see a Catholic, but the confessional in some of what he's doing. But different from the confessional, you're not sinning. Your thoughts aren't sins. And I see in Judaism less of a focus on thought being sin. And like there is in terms of your need to be compassion and thinking you're responsible for your thoughts. But there is a focus more on action and maybe more of a little bit of the thinking that we all do sin, that we miss the mark. But there seems to be a more of a compassionate, or I see a sort of less of a sense of one holding one's thoughts as this sinful mark on your soul, that you can contain them, you can have a space for that.
No, that's my own private. Yeah, because. Sorry, I just wanted to take up what you said about sin. I mean, in Joe's book, I don't know whether people have read it, but I mean, it's well worth reading. And on sale downstairs, and it's the Hidden Freud, and a central sort of plank of Joe's argument is the meeting that Freud had with the man who became the Grand Rabbi of Geneva, wasn't it? But as a student, he met Freud went to a conference at which this young man Safran was speaking, and Safran came to Freud's home, and Joe publishes a letter in which Safran, now as an old man, remembers what they were talking about. And he says that Freud, the whole conversation revolved around the text about, in the puzzling text about Cain and Abel, what God says about sin. And Safran says that Freud had the greatest interest in this verse, which it was about sin. So, even if he doesn't speak much about sin in his writings, this was an important concept, and about how, and it's all about responsibility. And is sin a state of mind, or is sin an action? And this verse is very, very elliptical and compressed, and you know the greatest rabbis have tried to puzzle out exactly the implications. And so Safran and Freud evidently they had what Safran called a long conversation. Again, the word long is left out of the translation. Your second edition, you must get a proper translation of the important letter.
I will consult you.
Yeah. And he says, he remembers having a long conversation in which Freud had the greatest interest in this subject.
Just to add a few words. There are two concepts which have been brought up by people. One is about wisdom. And the question is, what is the image of the Jew? Is the Jew seen as the usurer, the Christ killer, or is he wise? And one of the transformations, the positive transformation, that was taking place in the 18th century, leading into the 19th, is this concept of the Jew as a wise man. So Mendelssohn's friend, Moses Mendelssohn, the founder of the Jewish Enlightenment, had a close friend, Gotthelf Lessing. And Lessing wrote a play, Nathan der Weise, Nathan the Wise, in which the main, although it's set in the 12th century, and there is a Jew and a Christian and a Muslim, and it's a plea for religious tolerance. But the figure of the Jew is a wise man. And I think it's this wisdom, this concept of wisdom, which of course has a hermeneutic dimension, because the wisdom comes from the text. And as you said, the texts have gaps. And then you have a whole midrashic project of filling in the gaps. And it's as if Freud, in his dream interpretation, he is filling in the gaps of the text of the dream. So the dream has this item and that item, and then he's able to fill that in. Yes, that means this, and this means that. It's a constant midrashic project. So that's one element. The other issue is about force. Because in Hasidism, the great contribution that the Baal Shem Tov gave in the sort of Kabbalistic panoply of what is Hasidism about, is that he began to address what is happening in the thoughts of the person who is praying. And the person might get a thought which is a sexual thought. And this might disturb him because he's trying to be a very pure person praying to God. And instead, this thought of a beautiful woman or something like that comes into his mind. It's all addressing males. It's the next couple of generations, a Chabad teacher speaks about women having thoughts of men, but at this point it's men having thoughts of women. So which I wrote about somehow. So a man is having a thought of this attractive woman, and it's disturbing him in his prayer, and the Baal Shem Tov gives a recipe of how to deal with that. He says, you know what this thought does? What its origin is? It comes from the divine attribute love. And it's a way in which the divine attribute love has coalesced in your brain. And if you just see that this image of the beautiful woman is really an expression of the divine attribute love, you elevate the thought to its root and it dissolves away from being anything negative and it becomes something positive. Now, the theory of early Hasidism is that these very saintly figures didn't have their own thoughts of pretty girls. It was other people's thoughts. That there was a transaction which Rabbi Elimelech of Lizhensk wrote about, the brother of the famous Rav Zusya. So Rabbi Elimelech wrote that because of the transaction between the Hasid, the follower, and the Rebbe, And there is a certain bond between them, even that he gives a donation to the Rebbe, but that gives a spiritual bond between them. The Rebbe has thoughts which are not the thoughts of the Hasid, it's his actions. He slept with that girl when he shouldn't have done, or he did something. And now the Rebbe has that as a thought. And the Rebbe elevates the thought to the Sphira Chesed, and in that way he brings a tikkun, a healing, for the Chassid. Well, in fact, Zalman Shachter Shalomi wrote a very long... He wrote it first as a short article, The Dynamics of the Yechidut Transaction, and then in his book Spiritual Intimacy, it's about a quarter of the book, all about the Yechidut and that kind of transaction which takes place.
I'd just like to firstly say it's been marvellous listening to you. It's just a shame it's limited, and I hope it would be repeated, but with each of you having more time. What I'd like to say is, I don't have a deep knowledge of Judaism. I grew up with very little, and I'm coming to it later in life. And it appeals to me, it doesn't matter to me that a psychoanalysis is a science or whatever it might be. For me, it's a search for truth. And for me, that is what Judaism is about. And I read recently, I think it was the Torah portion, when Moses was on the mountain and God came in a cloud and he couldn't see his face, he would die. And I think that is our position. We cannot, we are all failures to some extent in the search for truth. That is the object for me of psychoanalysis. We confuse belief sometimes with knowing. And that is the best we can do. I've been thinking to myself, I know about splitting, so why do I split? I think I'd go insane if I didn't. And I think that may be true of other people. And it is a search for truth. I find the more I learn about Judaism, and I've learned very little, and about psychoanalysis, the more the two come together. I can't think of one without thinking of the other. And why I think psychoanalysis is Jewish is because we don't have a credo. We are always searching. We do not block ourselves with having to say, I believe in this. And I asked my rabbi, if I'm an agnostic, can I be a Jew? I am a Jew. I'm an agnostic. I can't say that there isn't a God, and I can't say that there is a God. But I can say that I am a Jew. We are a people. For me, it's not a religion. And as a people, we are constantly, I think, involved in searching for identity. Our history is one of constant change. We adopt an identity, and then the rug is taken from under me. From you, you can hear from my accent, I grew up in South Africa. And the question was, when will we have to leave? When will we have to leave?
2 minutes.
Okay. The search for identity is a Jewish search, and the psychoanalysis is involved in the search for identity. Thank you.
Thank you. Very moving. I think Joe's case for looking at the Hasidic roots of Freud's work is very strong. What Tali Lohenthal said, respect that enormously. What I do take issue with is calling psychoanalysis as science. I think to say it's a methodology, therefore it's a science, is a weak case. You could say torture requires methodology, but that doesn't make it science. Or writing poetry has a methodology, but poetry is not a science. What is a science? Well, Einstein was mentioned. When Einstein first proposed his hypothesis of general theory of relativity, it was an unproved hypothesis that it had within it the most important feature, as outlined by the philosopher of science Karl Popper, of falsifiability. It was possible to prove it wrong and possible to prove it right. It has never been proved wrong and it was subsequently proved right. If we are to look at psychoanalysis
as two people talking in a room. It needs to be proved in some way what Freud actually said, that the roots of psychoneurosis are in early childhood, and that if the patient is able in some way to have that insight into that, this, where Freud said, would be the only way of curing it. And even if it wasn't the only way, a way of curing it, I don't think it's possible to show that. I think the chesed, I think what Tully said about being in a room and that subjectivity and the feeling, all that is healing. I believe chesed is particularly healing. More than love, it seems to be a word that encompasses even more than the English word love. That is healing. And to call it a science, simply because of the methodology, you need to convince me more.
I think we'll have another evening, perhaps, on that subject anyway.
Can I just make one little comment? I want to go back to something I said about the Maharal of Prague. The Maharal of Prague is famous for making the golem. So someone called Joseph Davis, who did a lot of research in that area of history, he said, forget about the golem. He created people. He created people like his great students, Yontav Lippmann Heller and various others. And I think that is the way in which we can test psychoanalysis. The way it actually creates people, that the person who comes to the therapist and comes as a somewhat damaged and wounded person, and through the process of therapy, they become someone who can give help and aid. They become the wounded therapist, that they are then able to give to others. And I think that that is an observable, quantifiable phenomenon. And it's something that makes psychoanalysis stand up as a testable phenomenon in our cultural artifact, in our society.
So I want to thank you all for coming tonight. A lovely evening. I want to thank our panelists, Stephen, Polly, Anthony, even myself. And I just want to say that if you want to continue the discussion, depth. My recent book called The Hidden Freud is available downstairs.
And thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.